A podcast team started looking into the biggest hack in history and ended up in the middle of a story. A mysterious voicemail, disappearing files. It got personal. Breach is a new podcast that takes you inside the world's biggest hacks. They set out to answer questions about the hack of a huge American company and found themselves investigating a Russian conspiracy. Subscribe to Breach, that's B-R-E-A-C-H, in your podcast app right now. In the summer of 1969, Leslie Van Houten and Patricia Krenwinkel carried out horrific acts of butchery on the orders of the charismatic cult leader, Charles Manson. At their murder trial the following year, lead prosecutor Vincent Bugliosi described the two so-called Manson women as, quote, human monsters. But to anyone who knew them growing up, they were bright, promising girls, seemingly incapable of such an unfathomable crime. Now, in The Manson Women and Me, Peabody Award-winning journalist and psychotherapist Nikki Meredith takes a bold and insightful new look at one of the most notorious murders of the 20th century, revealing her surprisingly personal relationship with Van Houten and Krenwinkel, and asking the question that has nagged us for years: how do seemingly normal people commit such vicious, barbaric acts? The Manson Women and Me by Nikki Meredith is on sale now everywhere books are sold. For more info, visit kensingtonbooks.com/Nikki Meredith. That's NikkiMeredith. Now, on to today's episode. Captain Jim Macedo was holding a press conference in front of the police station in Calaveras County, California, on April 28, 2013. He was updating reporters on an investigation that they had been working on for the last 24 hours. An investigation so horrific that it had captivated not only the local area, but had captured the nation's attention as well. Captain Macedo assured reporters that they were working diligently through the night to try and find the murderer who was now undoubtedly still on the loose. He said they had executed a search warrant on the home where the murder had taken place the day before, and that they had collected what looked to be promising evidence.
We did collect some fingerprints during that search, and we also collected what we believe to be DNA. Those prints and that DNA will hopefully be processed within the next week.
He said they had no suspects or persons of interest at this time, and that they had notified the local school district and provided extra security to the local schools and bus stops. And although rumors had already been swirling around, and although most everyone in the community already knew what he was going to say next, he then officially identified the victim.
And at this point in time, we're going to release the victim's name and age. The victim in this case is Leila Fowler. It's L-E-I-L-A. She was a 9-year-old resident of Valley Springs. I did have some limited communication with the family today, and they have, when I asked them if there was anything they'd like me to pass on to the press and the public, they asked me to basically tell anybody that has any information about this case to please call in and call in immediately.
Leila Fowler was actually 8 years old, just 2 months shy of her 9th birthday. Hey everyone, this is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 50. On Saturday, April 27th, 2013, the day before that press conference, it was a typical spring day in Valley Springs, California. Valley Springs is located towards the center of the state, about 60 miles southeast of Sacramento and about 50 miles northeast of Modesto. It's a rather small town, a total of not quite a full 10 square miles, and the population in 2010 registered just over 3,500 residents. The Fowler family lived on the 5,600 block of Ripon Road. They were what some people would call a blended family. Barney Fowler, his fiancée, Crystal Walters, and 6 children, ranging from 1-year-old to 15, all lived at the home. On this particular spring morning, the majority of the family left the house at 7 a.m., to go to one of the kids' Little League baseball games. but 12-year-old Isaiah and 8-year-old Layla stayed home. It was 12:06 p.m. when Crystal received a frantic phone call from Isaiah. He told her that someone had come into the house, hit Layla, and then had run out. Crystal and Barney hurried home, leaving the rest of the kids at the baseball field with Crystal's grandmother. Crystal called 911 on their way.
Hi, 911, how can I help you? My children are at home alone, and a man just ran out of my house. My older son was in the bathroom, and my daughter started screaming.
Okay.
And he came out, there was a man inside of my house. I need an officer there.
Where is your house? The man is gone, though?
They said he ran out, but they're okay. Scared. I'm trying to...
Of course. So you had a break-in.
Yes.
Okay. Did they see the man? Were they able to describe him?
They did see him, yes. My daughter is freaking out right now.
Okay. What's your own phone number?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. We'll get somebody out there. I'm going to go ahead and call the house, okay?
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
The 911 operator dispatched police officers to the Fowler home and then called Isaiah. Isaiah told the dispatcher that he had been in the bathroom when he heard what sounded like a door slam. He then heard someone yelling and banging on the bathroom door. When he opened the door, he saw a man running out of the sliding glass back door. When asked to describe the man, he said he had long gray hair and was wearing a black shirt and blue jeans. He then told the dispatcher that the man had stabbed Layla a bunch of times and said that, quote, "she's like dead." When Barney and Crystal got home, they found Isaiah in the living room, a phone in one hand and a baseball bat in the other. They then went to check on Layla. She was lying on the floor of her bedroom, her legs buckled underneath her. She had a bloody cut on her forehead and blood on her shirt. Barney lifted up her shirt, which revealed multiple stab wounds. He picked her up and carried her down the hall and out the front door, where he was met by responding police officers. Calaveras County Sheriff's Deputy Sean Sacchini told Barney to place Layla down on the porch. Paramedics had arrived on the scene. They noted that she was cool to the touch, had no pulse, and wasn't breathing. Sacchini went inside to talk to Isaiah, who had blood smeared across his right forearm. Isaiah told him about the man he had seen running from the house. He said he had started to chase the man when he heard Layla call out, and so he went to check on her. Layla was taken to the hospital, where she was officially pronounced dead. While the Fowler family was at the hospital, Detective Wade Whitney met them there. He asked Barney if he had his permission to interview Isaiah for more information, and Barney said yes. Detective Whitney wanted to know more about the intruder, as a massive manhunt was about to get underway. Isaiah told him that he had woken up between 9 and 9:30 that morning and made breakfast. He and Layla watched a movie, and then Layla went to her room while he went to the bathroom. While he was in the bathroom, he said he heard a door slam and then heard someone yell, "Hey, I know you're in here. Come out." He then heard Layla scream. He described opening the bathroom door and seeing the man running towards the sliding glass back door. He said he started to follow him, but then realized that Layla might need help. So he ran towards her bedroom and grabbed a knife from the kitchen counter in case there was another intruder still in the home. He saw Layla lying on the floor, covered in blood. He said he dropped the knife, then picked it up again. He went back to the kitchen, put the knife on the counter, and called Crystal to tell her what had happened. Detective Whitney showed some photos of possible suspects to Isaiah, but he said none of them looked like the intruder. Detective Whitney then told Isaiah that he had to ask him a difficult question, but that Isaiah didn't have to answer it if he didn't want to, or if he didn't feel comfortable. "Did you do anything to harm your sister?" he asked. Isaiah said no. On April 29th, 2 days after the murder, a massive manhunt was underway for the suspicious intruder who had broken into the Fowler home and murdered an innocent 8-year-old. Authorities held press conference after press conference, describing the suspect they were looking for. By this time, a neighbor had come forward to say that she too had seen a man matching the description Isaiah gave, running from the home on the day of the murder. Investigators said they were looking for a white or Hispanic male with long gray hair, 6 feet tall, with a muscular build. He was last seen wearing a black long-sleeved shirt and blue jeans. He was considered armed and dangerous. The small town of Valley Springs had never experienced anything like this before. Residents normally felt safe in their neighborhoods, many never even bothering to lock their doors. But everything changed after Layla, one of their own children, was murdered. They were warned to be on high alert for any suspicious activity and to let the Calaveras County Sheriff's Office know if anyone they knew had suddenly left town or had unexplained injuries. Investigators, meanwhile, used search dogs and other volunteers and scoured through houses, attics, crawl spaces, sheds, and fields. They checked in with registered sex offenders and parolees in the area. Then, on May 1st, 4 days after the murder, it seemed like there could be a big break in the case. About an hour away from Valley Springs, in a town called Placerville, investigators responded to a 911 call that came in at about 8 a.m. from someone who said that a man was trying to kidnap a 15-month-old baby and that the mother was struggling with the suspect. Police immediately responded to the scene and took the man into custody. The child's mother told them that the man had followed her home and into her apartment. The man was 42-year-old Jason Wyrennan, and he was arrested and charged with kidnapping and burglary. The Placerville police captain told reporters that they were going to compare his DNA with the DNA found at the scene of the Fowler home to see if it was a match. The next day, Valley Springs investigators had another update for reporters, but this one wasn't so promising. They said the neighbor who had seen the suspect running from the Fowler home on the day of the murder was no longer considered a credible witness.
Yesterday, May 1st, 2013, detectives and a composite sketch artist met with a witness in this case for the purpose of developing a composite sketch of the person seen running near the Fowler home. This witness had earlier provided a description of this person to investigators on two separate occasions. The witness had also stated that she saw the intruder running in the opposite direction from the direction that Leela's 12-year-old brother had provided to us earlier. During the composite sketch meeting, the witness recanted her previous statements and her identification of the man she saw running away. She also refused to provide a description to the sketch artist so that a composite could be completed. The witness's description of the running man was an important lead for our investigators, but as of now, it has become clear that this witness is no longer credible.
Sergeant Chris Hewitt said the witness did not explain why she was recanting or why she, quote, acted the way she did, but that it was deemed non-credible. But, he said, it wasn't a setback in their investigation. Instead, it would actually allow them to narrow their scope. But despite what he said, the investigation seemed to have stalled, to outsiders at least. A man had come forward saying that he had driven another man home the day of the murder, who was covered in blood. That had seemed like a promising lead, but investigators said they had talked to that man and had cleared him. They also said that they cleared Jason Wyrennan, the man accused of kidnapping in nearby Placerville. But then, on May 11th, an arrest was finally made, one that would stun not only the community, but the nation. On Saturday, May 11th, 2013, 2 weeks after the murder, Layla's 12-year-old brother, Isaiah Fowler, was arrested.
Today, Calaveras County Sheriff's Office detectives arrested the murderer of 8-year-old Layla Fowler. At 5:10 p.m., detectives arrested Layla's 12-year-old brother at the Valley Springs substation on charges of homicide.
Citizens of Calaveras County can sleep a little better tonight, Calaveras County Sheriff Gary Kuntz said. Many members in the community were shocked, while some had suspected it all along. But many felt betrayed and some of them even told reporters that they wanted money they had donated to Layla's family back. And Layla's family, well, they decided to stand by Isaiah, saying that they believed that there had been an intruder and that Isaiah was innocent. Barney Fowler told the Associated Press, quote, "Until they have the proper evidence to show that it's my son, we're standing behind him. If they have the evidence, well, that's another story. We're an honest family." Isaiah was charged with second-degree murder with a special allegation for the use of a dangerous weapon. He pleaded not guilty. Now remember that Isaiah was just 12 years old at the time, facing one of the most serious charges even an adult could face. But that meant that instead of an adult court, he would be facing trial in a juvenile court, which also means that the public typically won't have access to those records, not the trial transcripts, nor the police reports, or most documents that I'm usually able to secure when covering adult cases. So most of the following information from here on out is from those court records that were made available, along with news reports at the time. Isaiah remained in custody while he awaited his trial, but his defense team, paid for by his family, fought hard to prepare. In June 2014, the defense filed a motion to suppress statements that Isaiah had made to police in the hours and even days after the murder. Unbeknownst to the public, Isaiah had met with investigators on four separate occasions. In addition to his initial conversation with Detective Wade Whitney at the Fowler home, immediately after officers had responded to the scene, he was interviewed a second time while the Fowler family was at the hospital. Detective Whitney had asked Barney for permission to talk to Isaiah again and to get more information about the intruder, and Barney had agreed. Isaiah repeated his story about seeing the intruder flee from the home, and that interview lasted for about 16 minutes. Then, later that same day, Detective Whitney again asked Barney if he could interview Isaiah, and again, Barney agreed. They drove to the district attorney's office and took Isaiah to an interview room, while Barney watched from an observation room. This interview was considerably longer, lasting approximately 77 minutes. Before the interview started, Detective Whitney told Isaiah that he was there to talk to them as a witness and that the doors were open and he was not under arrest, that he was free to leave at any time, and that his dad was just in the other room. Isaiah again repeated his story about having been in the bathroom when he heard a man with an accent yelling, "Hey, I know you're in here, come out," then hearing Layla scream and opening the door in time to see the man running out. He estimated that about 10 seconds had likely passed between when he heard the man's voice and when he opened the door. He described chasing after the man, then stopping and going to the kitchen to grab a knife and going to Layla's room. He stressed that he didn't enter her room, but could see her body from the doorway. Isaiah was interviewed a third time 2 days later on April 29, 2013. The Fowler family had gone to the district attorney's office to fill out paperwork for the county's victim witness program. While there, Detective Whitney came to take DNA samples from the family, and once again, he asked Barney if they could interview Isaiah. Barney consented to another interview. This time, Isaiah would be talking to Sergeant Tim Sturm and Detective Josh Crabtree. This interview lasted for approximately 84 minutes. In this interview, the officers noted two differences in Isaiah's statements between what he was saying then and what he had told Detective Whitney prior. First, Isaiah had told them that the intruder had banged on the bathroom door, and although this was something he did say in his 911 call, he hadn't said that to Detective Whitney. Secondly, in this interview, Isaiah didn't say anything about having grabbed a knife from the kitchen. The part about grabbing the knife, dropping it when he saw Layla, and then taking it back to the kitchen was completely left out. Sergeant Sturm and Detective Crabtree told Isaiah that they had both made mistakes when they were younger and that they had always been forgiven. They told him that no matter what he said today, he would still get to leave there with his parents. Sergeant Sturm said, quote, "You're going home with your mom and dad today, okay? But we need to know. There is no man that ran out of that house, is there? Isaiah responded, Yeah, there is. I saw him. Sergeant Sturm then asked about Isaiah's 911 call with the dispatcher, where he said that Layla had been stabbed. He asked how Isaiah could have known that if he didn't go into Layla's room. Isaiah responded, I don't know. I could have seen it, I guess. Sergeant Sturm and Detective Crabtree then told Isaiah that they had DNA evidence, establishing him as the killer. One of them said, quote, The evidence tells us, obviously, there was something bad that happened in that house. And the evidence doesn't tell us that there was a man, a great big man, running through your house with you. They urged him to confess and feel better, saying that his parents would love him no matter what. But Isaiah continued to say that he didn't do it. During this interview, the longer it went on, Barney, who had been waiting outside and who was not in the observation room, had begun growing impatient. The family had only intended on filling out the victim witness paperwork that day and then leaving. He kept asking the officers he saw how much longer it would be, and they kept telling him to be patient, just a few minutes longer. Finally, Barney demanded that they end it, and so they did. The fourth and final interview occurred on May 9th, 2013. The Fowler family was asked to come back to the district attorney's office and were told that investigators wanted to interview each of the children separately to show them photographs of sex offenders and discuss family dynamics. Barney and Crystal agreed, as long as one of them was allowed to observe. Crystal observed Isaiah's interview this time, with Detective Crabtree and FBI Special Agent Sam Dilland. This interview was the longest one yet, lasting about 97 minutes. As they had in their other interviews, they told Isaiah that he was free to leave and to let them know if he didn't want to answer any of their questions. Isaiah again went over the events of the morning of April 27th. When he got to the part about being in the bathroom and hearing the man yelling, he was asked whether it was banging or just yelling, and Isaiah said, just yelling. He then recounted chasing the man to the door, then running towards Layla's room and stopping in the doorway. Again, he made no mention of a knife. Agent Dilland and Detective Crabtree told Isaiah that none of his neighbors had seen anyone matching the suspect's description, that there were no tire tracks, that blood dogs didn't track anything outside of the house, there were no fingerprints at the home, and that there was really no evidence of an intruder. Agent Dilland implied that accidents can happen and asked if it had all been an accident, and Isaiah said no. They then presented Isaiah with a photo of a Ghostbusters t-shirt that had blood on it and said the blood dogs had hit on it in a hamper in Isaiah's room. Isaiah told them that he could have changed his shirt, but that he wasn't sure. At this time, Crystal realized that after they showed him the photo of the t-shirt, that they were viewing him as a suspect, so she said she wanted the interview to conclude. As the family was leaving the parking lot, Deputy Sheriff Heather Gordon approached them and confirmed what they had suspected, that Isaiah was in fact being looked at as a suspect. She told them that the evidence they had collected all pointed towards him as having been the killer. Barney agreed to let them continue to interview Isaiah, as long as he was able to confront him with the evidence and not them. He told them that he could get the truth out of his son if he was hiding it. So, with Barney taking the lead in this interview, they headed back to the interview room. This part lasted for about 43 minutes. Detective Crabtree outlined the evidence they had against Isaiah and said they had no evidence that anyone else was in the house at all. Barney turned to Isaiah and said, quote, Okay, this is the deal. They have evidence that points back to you. So what I want to know, or what I want us to talk about, is that if for some reason there was an accident, and for some reason you did hurt your sister, you got to talk to him. Now just tell him yes, you did it, and what the deal is. He told Isaiah that if he did it, either he admits it, or the police will continue to gather their evidence and arrest him, and that it's going to be a big scene. Isaiah said he didn't remember anything. A little while later, after more back and forth, Barney told Isaiah, quote, I'm not saying I'm going to hate you and never talk to you, but I need to know why, if this is what's going on. There's no proof of nobody being in the house but you and your sister. He told him not to worry about disappointing him, that he would support him if he was honest. Quote, we're here to take care of you, right or wrong, okay? So you need to talk to them. If you did something, they need to know so they can move forward. Can't move forward until you talk to them. Isaiah responded that he didn't do it. Agent Dilland told him that his parents were there for him, but that they wanted to know what happened to Layla. I can't remember, Isaiah said. From what point don't you remember? Agent Dilland asked him. I don't remember doing it, he said. But I guess I did. I don't know. So was that a confession? We'll see what happens next, right after this quick break from today's sponsors. Driven by the mission to provide a better place to sleep for everybody, Lisa is an innovative direct-to-consumer online mattress brand that is also socially conscious. In fact, for every 10 mattresses Lisa sells, they donate one to a shelter through their 110 program. They also plant one tree for every mattress sold and donate 1% of each employee's time to volunteer for local causes. Not to mention, with a patented universal adaptive feel, Lisa is designed for all types of sleepers and features three premium foam layers, including 2-inch Avena foam top layer for cooling and breathability, 2-inch memory foam middle layer for body contouring and pressure relief, and 6-inch dense core support foam for durability and structure, which works for sleepers of all sizes. And now, Lisa is continuing to expand its offerings to include the Lisa Pillow, Blanket, Foundation, and Frame. No wonder it's a Forbes Top 20 startup to watch. Try a Lisa mattress in your own home for 100 nights risk-free. Available in the US, UK, Canada, and Germany online with free shipping. This 100% American-made mattress ships compressed in a box right to your door. Or try it at the Lisa Dream Gallery in Soho, New York City and Virginia Beach, and at over 80 West Elm stores nationwide. Get $125 off and a free pillow when you go to leesa.com/junkie. I want you all to imagine what you would do with a crisp new $100 bill every day. Go ahead and think about it. I'll give you a second. Did you imagine throwing that $100 bill away? I didn't think so. But if you're a woman and you're not investing, that could be like losing a fresh new Benjamin every day. That's why there's Elevest, the online investment platform for women. Invest in specific life goals such as buying a house, starting a business, or retiring your way on your terms. Elevest gives you a free, customized financial plan based on goals you choose and shows you how much to invest each month until you reach those goals. And it even sets up recurring deposits to help you stay on track. All you have to do is get started. And now, Court Junkie listeners can receive $100 towards your first funded goal when you sign up with Elevest. Visit elevest.com/court. That's ELLEVEST.com/court to receive $100 towards your first funded goal. There was more back and forth in the interview room, with the investigators continuing to tell Isaiah that there was no evidence of an intruder and asking him why he didn't ask for an ambulance on the 911 call. The following description of Isaiah during this portion of questioning is from one of the court documents. Quote, for the next several minutes, Isaiah sat gripping the sides of his chair and staring fixedly at the floor. He sniffed continuously and appeared to be fighting tears. Crabtree and Dilland spoke in soft, soothing tones, offering assurances that Barney would not be angry. Barney, for his part, quietly and calmly urged Isaiah to be honest. After more than 15 minutes, much of which passed in near silence, save for the sound of his sniffling, Isaiah began to cry. Barney rose from his chair and put an arm around Isaiah. Isaiah stood and embraced his father, weeping. After a few more minutes of back and forth, Isaiah continued to say that he didn't remember, and Barney said the interview was over. So now, naturally, as with any time a suspect speaks with investigators, the prosecution wanted to use the statements Isaiah made in those interviews against him at trial, and the defense wanted to do their best to make sure that that didn't happen. So in June 2014, the defense filed a motion to suppress on Fourth Amendment grounds. But the juvenile court denied their motion, stating, quote, "The court finds that each of the four separate interviews that are the subject of this matter were given entirely with the consent of the father, as well as the minor himself. When the consent was withdrawn in these cases, all interviews had stopped." That following February, in February 2015, the defense filed another motion, this one requesting that Isaiah, who was now 14, be released from custody pending additional testing, saying that the prosecution had the wrong man and that they could now prove it. The defense's motion first pointed out what they called the lack of evidence against Isaiah. They noted that while prosecutors were saying that a serrated knife found in the kitchen of the Fowler home was the murder weapon, the coroner who performed the autopsy excluded that knife, as well as all others shown to him from the home, as the murder weapon. The motion also points out the lack of blood found on Isaiah, on his clothes, and on the knife prosecutors believe was the murder weapon. If Isaiah had been the killer, there would have had to have been a cleanup. Yet when all the drains and traps from the sinks and tubs were collected, there was no evidence of Layla's blood, nor any evidence that any cleaning products had recently been used, either on the items or in the plumbing. The defense wrote, quote, "Given the implausibility of any perpetrator pulling off such a cleanup without traces of it being detected by the FBI and Department of Justice, it must be emphasized that the accused was 12 years old at the time of the offense, i.e., when the prosecution theorizes he must have pulled off just such a feat." And then, the potential bombshell. The defense wrote in their motion that another piece of evidence had come to light, one that would prove that there had been an intruder in the house, an unknown male's DNA on a hair found on Layla's body. The defense had ordered testing that month prior, in January, and had found the DNA on a strand of Layla's hair, retrieved from under her underwear. A hearing was held on February 20th, 2015, to argue the motion, and the defense came out swinging, saying that it was, quote, "fundamentally wrong to continue to detain him while the prosecution struggles to salvage a floundering case against him." Isaiah's attorney, Mark Reichel, said that they now have scientific evidence that shows that an adult male was very close to Layla shortly before her demise, close enough to deposit significant DNA. But the prosecution argued strongly against Isaiah's release. District Attorney Barbara Uke told the judge that Isaiah is a danger to others, and she referenced two incidents he allegedly had at school. One in which she said he threatened another child while holding a knife in his hand, and the other, where he allegedly referenced the Sandy Hook mass school shooting and said, quote, "I could do something like that." Uke also argued that there was evidence of a substantial cleanup at the Fowler home and that Layla's blood was found on Isaiah's shirt and on a knife. She said the knife had been washed and placed on the counter and the shirt had been found in the hamper. She also said Isaiah gave inconsistent statements. She said when he spoke with the 911 dispatcher and was, quote, "unusually calm," he said that the suspect had been a black man, but later he told the police that he was Mexican. And, she said, he even confessed to the crime at one point. "We believe his placement is for the best of his welfare at this time," she said. Steve Plesser, another one of Isaiah's defense attorneys, addressed what Prosecutor Uke said in his rebuttal. With regard to Isaiah's alleged prior behavior, he said both of her accounts, where he allegedly threatened a boy at school while holding a knife, and where he allegedly made that comment about Sandy Hook, were inaccurate. He said that Isaiah did have a pocket knife, one a relative had given him, and that it had fallen out during gym class, and so he had gotten into trouble, but said he never threatened anyone with it. And as for Sandy Hook, he said Isaiah didn't even know what Sandy Hook was. In that 911 call, one we'll likely never be able to hear, by the way, since he was a juvenile, Plesser said Isaiah told the dispatcher that the suspect was possibly Latino and was wearing a black shirt. And as for the admission of guilt, Plesser said that Isaiah was interviewed a number of times without his parents, and that at one point he said, quote, "I don't remember. I guess I did it. I don't remember, but I didn't do it." He said that statement is invalid and that every other time he has insisted that he's innocent. The forensic evidence the prosecution has was not damaging to Isaiah, Plesser argued, pointing out that there was no blood spatter found on Isaiah's t-shirt. He then went back to the DNA and said that it was in a place where, quote, "no male's DNA should be on an 8-year-old girl's body." Judge Thomas A. Smith denied the defense's request and said that they didn't provide any new evidence showing that Isaiah was innocent, that they had only made an assertion but hadn't included lab reports or expert statements to support it. So Isaiah remained in jail. Going into trial, the defense tried once again to prove their client's innocence, this time with a polygraph exam. They sat Isaiah down with who they said was one of the best polygraphers in the U.S., Ronald Hilly, a former FBI agent who now trains FBI agents. The test lasted for nearly 2 hours, and after asking Isaiah if he had anything to do with the murder of his sister in several different ways, the results concluded no deception. He had passed with flying colors. The defense then sent the results to two independent polygraph experts who agreed with their conclusion. In fact, they said, the score was so high that the chances of a deceptive person producing the same results was only 2 in 1,000. Mark Reichel said, quote, "With the polygraph, we are thrilled to be able to prove with certainty that our client is innocent, and yet we and the Fowler family remain concerned that the violent murderer of an 8-year-old girl is still out there. The first step towards justice is for the case to be dismissed so that authorities can renew their search for the suspect." But just before testimony began, Judge Thomas Smith ruled that the polygraph was inadmissible under California law. Isaiah's trial, which in juvenile court is actually referred to as a contested jurisdictional hearing, began on September 15th, 2015. Now, like I said before, I don't have audio or transcripts of what exactly was said at this trial or hearing, but using court documents and various news reports, I put together the best summary I could. But before I get to that, I just want to outline what the prosecution's theory of the case is versus what the defense put forth. The prosecution believes that Isaiah murdered Layla at some point in the morning, cleaned himself and the scene up, and then called Crystal and his father around noon to tell them that an intruder had broken in. They believe he used a knife from the kitchen as the weapon. The defense, on the other hand, maintains that an intruder killed Layla. They say that Layla was attacked right before Isaiah made that phone call, and that there wouldn't have been any time for him to have cleaned up if he had done it. And even if the murder weapon was the knife found in the kitchen, it doesn't mean Isaiah was the one who used it. Now, onto their evidence. First, the state entered the 911 call between Isaiah and the 911 dispatcher into evidence. Isaiah told the dispatcher that the intruder, quote, "stabbed her a bunch of times." And when asked where the stab wounds were, he responded, "all over her." The dispatcher asked, "you don't have any idea who the intruder was?" And Isaiah said, "no, I've never seen him before in my life." The first sheriff's deputy to respond to the Fowler home testified that Layla's body was cool to the touch when he first got there. He theorized that Layla had been dead for a while before Isaiah had called and reported it. And a paramedic named Drake Morehouse also testified that Layla's body felt cool to the touch. However, on cross-examination, he was questioned why his report read that the body was warm, pale, and dry. He said an intern had filled out the report for him and said that he hadn't proofread it. Another item entered into evidence was the steak knife that the prosecution said was the murder weapon, a 3.5-inch serrated knife that had been found on the kitchen counter in the Fowler home. The knife had a bent blade and had microscopic damage to the point, as well as had traces of Layla's blood under the handle. And Dr. Robert Lawrence, the pathologist who performed Layla's autopsy, testified that Layla's wounds were consistent with a knife such as that one. He also told the court that Layla was stabbed more than 20 times to her upper body while she was still on the top bunk of her bed. The majority of the wounds were prod injuries, meaning that they didn't penetrate deeply and that they may have been inflicted in order to intimidate or abuse her. However, the stab wound that pierced her right ventricle was the official cause of her death. Dr. Lawrence estimated that it would take about 45 minutes to 2 hours for the body to change temperature, seemingly backing up the prosecution's timeline. However, on cross-examination, Dr. Lawrence was asked about Layla's capillary refill rate, which is essentially how long it takes for blood to return to the fingernails when you put pressure on them. Her rate was less than 2 seconds, the same as it would be had she been alive or newly deceased. Prosecutors also brought in a senior criminalist with the California Department of Justice, Libby Schreiber, who testified that she had found traces of human blood beneath the handle of the knife prosecutors believed to be the murder weapon. Another criminalist and DNA expert testified that that blood was Layla's. Bradley Swanson, an assistant lab director for the California Department of Justice, said Layla was on her top bunk, but it ultimately ended up on the floor across the room. He said he can't say how she got there, but that there was no blood trail, meaning that she got there quickly and could have either jumped off the bed or was thrown. Now, the defense's case revolved around three premises. One, that there was not enough evidence against Isaiah to prove that he was the killer. Two, that police had used coercive methods to try and get him to confess. And three, that an unknown intruder was the one who came in and killed Layla, not Isaiah. They called their own pathologist to the stand, who said Layla's autopsy report was too brief and that it lacked crucial information that would make identifying a murder weapon impossible. Terry Haddix, a forensic pathologist with more than 20 years of experience, said the wounds in the report weren't photographed individually and that they provided an overview of the injuries, but not much context. She said many of the photos didn't include the instruments pathologists normally use to measure length, width, and depth of the wounds. And in other photos, the 90-degree measuring scale hadn't been used correctly. She said some wounds show that they were broad, while others were blunted, meaning that the wounds were complicated. Then the defense called Kenton Wong, a forensic scientist and expert on blood spatter, to the stand. Wong testified that he did not believe that Isaiah would have been able to clean up after the killing, saying that adults have trouble cleaning blood off themselves and a crime scene. On cross-examination, the prosecution brought up the theory that Isaiah may have been shirtless during the killing and that he could have cleaned blood from his face, hair, and skin by jumping into the shower. Wong agreed that that could happen, but also said that the shower would then have likely contaminated everything else in the shower. Barney Fowler testified that it wasn't unusual for Isaiah to babysit Layla and that they had a great relationship. And contrary to what the sheriff's deputy and paramedic had said, he said that when he first saw Layla's body, there was blood flowing from the wounds when he lifted her shirt and that he believed that she was still alive. Several witnesses from the Fowler's neighborhood testified about seeing suspicious persons in the area around the time of Layla's murder. Their testimonies varied, and each person's description of who they saw was different, but the times and locations were similar. A friend of Isaiah's older sister testified that there was an empty abandoned house in the neighborhood that she and Isaiah's sister went to in the days before Layla's murder. Inside, they saw a television on and other signs that someone had been squatting there. She said a male voice shouted at them to leave, causing them to quickly run away. The defense told the court that the prosecution's forensic evidence was ambiguous and that Dr. Lawrence, their pathologist, had initially excluded the steak knife as the murder weapon, but then revised that conclusion at the prosecution's request. There was no forensic evidence tying Isaiah to the crime, they said, but there was evidence of an intruder, including the male DNA recovered from one of Layla's hairs that had been found inside of her underwear. They noted that it had been likely deposited by bodily fluid, such as blood, semen, or saliva, even though the coroner had ruled that there had been no sexual assault noted on Layla's body. They said two fingerprints had also been recovered from the doorframe leading into Layla's bedroom, and although the prosecution believed those prints were Layla's, they were never conclusively matched. The defense also said that there was no motive for Isaiah to have wanted to kill his sister. The judge rendered his verdict after hearing all the evidence in the case. He said, quote, "We have before us a very bright young man. He is the top 10% of the intelligent students in his class, although he is an underachiever." He then went over the inconsistencies in Isaiah's statements and noted that the evidence of Layla's blood on the damaged knife was, quote, "the strongest evidence because the statements of Isaiah Fowler just don't make sense." He found the allegations of second-degree murder to be true beyond a reasonable doubt, and he sentenced him to 16 years to life in prison. But because he was a juvenile, Judge Smith said that by law, he would be released on August 22, 2023, at the age of 23. He could be released a year earlier than that, depending on his behavior during incarceration. The judge also addressed how well Isaiah was doing since his arrest, noting that he was already on track to graduate from high school at 16 and will be able to take college classes while incarcerated. Quote, "I am going to congratulate you for your performance in juvenile hall. It's been a complete turnaround in your life. It's this court's wish that you make the most of it during incarceration." When I first got the idea to cover this case, it was because a listener had reached out to me, asking me if I could believe that a young kid who had been convicted of killing his sister was now getting a new trial, essentially based on a technicality, he wrote. And the case that he was referring to was Isaiah Fowler. That's right, in February 2018, Isaiah got a huge break. His conviction was thrown out, meaning that the case may go to trial all over again. In the ruling, the appeals judge wrote, quote, "Isaiah Fowler appeals, arguing the juvenile court erroneously admitted his pre-arrest statements in violation of Miranda v. Arizona. We agree that two of four challenged statements were inadmissible. Because the Miranda error was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt under Chapman v. California, we reverse and remand for further proceedings." So, to put this in layman's terms, Isaiah's statements to law enforcement during those interviews were deemed not admissible at trial because he was not read his rights beforehand. The Calaveras County District Attorney's Office has yet to comment on the new developments or what they plan to do. It's not clear yet whether the California Attorney General will ask the California Supreme Court to review the reversal, or if it will just go back to the DA's office, where they'll have to ultimately decide whether to retry Isaiah without the use of his statements, or to drop the charges against him. Isaiah's family issued a statement reading, quote, "It's been a long 5 years. Isaiah is innocent. Our family hopes to get justice and figure out who did this to Layla." As always, I'll be keeping an eye on this one, and we'll post an update when it's available. And that's all for this episode. A special thank you to Scott for helping me out with the legal research on this one. And thank you to Smokeball, a law practice management software company that definitely would have been helpful back when I worked at a law firm years ago. I know I have a lot of legal eagles listening to this podcast, and I think you're really going to like this. Smokeball is the only case management software that automatically records your time and activity for you, which is why the most profitable small law firms use Smokeball to stay organized, improve productivity, and increase profitability. Get daily digest updates, law firm insight reports, automatic Word to PDF creation, over 14,000 automated legal forms, dedicated account management, and much more. And now, Court Junkie listeners can receive 50% off the onboarding fee when you sign up with Smokeball. Just visit smokeball.com/court to get started. That's smokeball.com/court to learn more and schedule your free demo. I'd also love to know what you guys think about today's case. Do you think Isaiah is guilty of murder? Do you think he should have been convicted? And if he is retried, do you think the prosecution can get a conviction without his statements? You can let me know by joining my Facebook discussion group, which you can find at courtjunkie.com/Facebook, by tweeting me at courtjunkiepod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. And as a reminder, if you like this podcast but don't care for hearing the ads, you can get each episode earlier than everyone else and get them ad-free. Just go to courtjunkie.com/support, and that will direct you to my Patreon page. You sign up there, get set up to donate $1 or more a month, and you'll get an exclusive RSS feed that you can add to any podcast listening app, or you can just listen online, whatever your preference is. If you donate $3 or more, I'll send you some Court Junkie stickers that you can stick to your laptops, refrigerators, or any other surface area. That's courtjunkie.com/support. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.